Now, we recall that when the flood ended, there were 8 survivors. And we read here that all flesh died in Genesis 7, verse number 21, that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beasts and of creeping things that creepeth upon the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was a breath of life, and all that was in the dry land died. So aside from the ark, the animals that were in the ark, Noah, his wife, and his 3 sons and their wives, there were no human survivors or animal survivors. Now, after the flood was over and the land began to dry, and it did take many, many years, not just a few years, a few hundreds of years for all of the floodwaters to completely dry up. As I commented earlier, even as late as around maybe 1500 BC, Europe was regarded as a swamp, and Scandinavia was thought to be an island. And the Pripyat marshes allowed the Vikings to row all the way across from the Vistula River, across into the rivers that ran into the Black Sea, and then make big excursion raids all along the Black Sea and the entire length of the Mediterranean coast. But God did make this promise. He said here in Genesis, the 9th chapter, I do set, or I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a token of the covenant between me and the earth, and it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. So we have that promise from God that any future destruction would not be in the form of a flood. We know what the future destruction will be. It will be in the form of fire, as the Bible tells us in numerous other places. So now we come to Genesis, the 9th chapter, and verse 18. The sons of Noah that went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now we have a particular incident listed here because of what involved Canaan. And that was the incident of Noah and the drunkenness. And after that, we read in verse 29, Genesis 9, all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. So he was one of the oldest living beings. The oldest one was Methuselah, who lived 969 years, and he either died the year of the flood or he died in the flood. We're not sure. But Noah was 950 years. So he lived 350 years after the flood. So what we're beginning to see here is that there was quite an overlapping in the lives of these individuals, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who lived long lives too, not as long as in the pre-flood world, but many of them lived a good period of time. We have Japheth, we have mentioned here in Genesis chapter 10, verse 1, these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood, no doubt, and daughters. And we have here a listing of the sons of Japheth. We don't need to go through all this table of nations here because that's not relevant to our subject. Our subject, remember, is the mighty acts and miracles of God. So we have a summary here of the sons of Ham. But we do find something interesting here because all of a sudden, before we have any summary of the children of Shem, we find an incident described here about an individual who was a descendant of Ham. And we read this here in verse number 7. The sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Raamah, Satitha, and the sons of Ramah, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. So you see, the sons of Ham, the first one mentioned here is Cush. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar, And out of that land, and if you'll notice your marginal reference is the most accurate one to use here, he went out into Assyria and builded Nineveh. And the city Rehoboth and Calah and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same is a great city. So we find an individual described here who is extraordinary, and who, as the Bible states here, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean that he was a mighty hunter with God's approval. The whole implication here is he is a mighty hunter who took the place of the Lord. Now, we need a little bit of history here, because we're really dealing with two things here today. We're dealing with this individual and what he accomplished, but we're also dealing with the Tower of Babel, because this is what is culminating in. I have three books I'm going to be reading from today, if I get that far along, and I trust that I will. And if I can find a particular place here I'm looking for, it's toward the back of this particular book here, which, by the way, is entitled The Two Babylons. And I want to find the section here that deals with what he accomplished and why the world went after him. Here it describes, and these particular sources that are being quoted by the author here in the Two Babylons are classical writers. Now remember, classical writers were ancient writers who were writing beginning in the classical period, which begins about 700 BC. So we're looking from a time period about 700 BC on down to, let's say, roughly the AD period. And these are writers who are commenting on the historical information they had at the time. And we have here the exploits of Nimrod. Now notice we read back here, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now why was he a mighty hunter? All right, here's what the Two Babylons tells us. The amazing extent of the worship of this man indicates something very extraordinary in his character. There's ample reason to believe that in his own day he was an object of high popularity. Though by setting up as king, Nimrod invaded the patriarchal system and abridged the liberties of mankind. Now you remember after the flood, we had Noah, and then we had his three sons. And the whole world was set up under a patriarchal system, not under a system of kingdoms. So he abridged that, as we read here. He broke away from the patriarchal system, that is, the authority of the patriarchs that they exercised in their families and in their regions. He broke away from that and established a new system. He abridged the liberties of mankind, yet he was held by many to have conferred benefits upon them that amply indemnified them for the loss of their liberties. Now, where have we heard that before? What do you think socialism is all about? What do you think communism is all about? You give up your rights for the benefits the state provides for you. So you give up your liberty for security. And that's exactly what these people were doing. He covered him with glory and renown, and by the time that he appeared, the wild beasts of the forest, multiplying more rapidly than the human race, must have committed great depredations upon the scattered and straggling populations of the earth, and must have inspired terror in the minds of men. Well, I can tell you, when you have a man-eating animal, a man-eating tiger or a man-eating lion, you have a real problem. There was a man in India by the name of Jim Corbett. He was an employee working for the British railroad companies over there. And there were such depredations being carried out by man-eating tigers and leopards over there that he would be given leaves of absence as much as 6 months at a time to do nothing but hunt these man-eating tigers and these leopards. And he killed many of them. And one that he killed had killed more human beings than any other. It was a man-eating leopard that killed over 450 people. Once they lose their fear of man, this man-eating leopard would just barge right through the doors, break the doors down, and drag people out of their homes. And those people over there, they weren't armed. They didn't have the means of protecting themselves. So we had the same situation here. The danger arising to the lives of men from such a source as this, when population is scanty, is implied in the reason given by God himself for not driving out the doomed Canaanites before Israel. Because he said, remember this quote here? I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. But little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased. The exploits of Nimrod, therefore, in hunting down the wild beasts of the field and ridding the world of monsters must have gained for him the character of a preeminent benefactor of his race. And by this means, not less than by the bands he trained, was his power acquired when he first began to be mighty upon the earth, and in the same way, no doubt, was that power consolidated. Then over and above, as the first great city builder after the flood, by gathering men together into masses and surrounding them with walls, he did still more to enable them to pass their days in security, free from the alarms which they had been exposed in their scattered life, when no one could tell that at any moment he might be called to engage in deadly conflict with prowling wild beasts in defense of his own life and those that were dear to him. So what did he do? He built big fenced cities and had everybody move inside where they'd be safe. In fact, over in Africa, when they have problems with man-eaters there, the natives would build big high walls of thorn bushes all the way around and tie them down good so they couldn't be torn up, because a lion would... See, animals are not stupid. These lions could not risk injury. That's a lot of times why they won't fight. If they're coming in against another animal that's equal to it or some dangerous prey, they won't fight because they don't want to risk an injury. What happens if they get an injury? They can't hunt any longer. They starve to death. So they'll go to great lengths to avoid injury. So these natives would tie big bundles of thorn, heavy thorn bushes all the way around their encampment to protect themselves at night from these lions and tigers. In fact, one time Corbett was up in a tree, and when he went up the tree that night, he was watching over a bait at night, and he had the Indians' helpers there wrap thorn bushes all the way around the trunk of the tree to about 10 feet high. And that night, that leopard came down there, and it wouldn't climb up the tree because it didn't want to get in the thorns, but it yanked and tried to pull the ropes loose to tear the thorns down while he was sitting up in the tree. Within the battlement of a fortified city, no such danger from savage animals was to be dreaded. And for security afforded in this way, men no doubt looked at themselves as greatly indebted to Nimrod. No wonder, therefore, that the name Mighty Hunter was the same as a prototype of God of Fortifications should have become a name of renown. Had Nimrod gained renown only thus, it would have been well. But not content with delivering men from the fear of wild beasts, he set about to emancipate them from the fear of God, which is the beginning of wisdom, and in which alone true happiness can be found. And by this very thing, he seems to have gained one of the titles by which men delighted to honor him as the Emancipator or Deliverer. The reader may remember one of his names was Pharaonius, and this applies to the same time as Nimrod, and he lived about the time when men used one speech, when the confusion of tongues began, and when mankind was scattered abroad. He is said to have been the first that gathered mankind into communities, the first of mortals that reigned, and the first that offered idolatrous sacrifices. That character can agree with none other than Nimrod, gathering men, as the two Babylons tells us here, together, offering idolatrous sacrifice is very significant. So, the meaning of it is to set free, that is the name of the word Pharaonius, and therefore his own adherents adopted it and glorified the great apostate from the primeval faith, though he was the first that abridged the liberties of mankind as a great emancipator, and hence in one form or another this title was handed down to his deified successors with the same honor. So what he did is he led men away from the patriarchal faith. He delivered their minds from the awe of God and the fear of the judgments of heaven. And while the memory of the flood must have still rested upon, and according to all the principles of depraved human nature, for men will readily rally around who can give them the latest appearance of plausibility to any doctrine that will teach them that they can be assured happiness and heaven at last, though their hearts and natures are unchanged, and though they live without God in the world. So you see what this man did. Not only did he free or rid that society or that community from these very dangerous man-eating animals, but then he went one step further, and he began to gain military power. He trained these young men in military exploits and war when the rest of the people were scattered living in a patriarchal society. And as it says here, under the name of Ninus, king of the Assyrians, he was the first who carried war against his neighbors. He conquered all nations from Assyria to Libya. That's the whole Middle East. So he had quite an extensive kingdom. And this account points to Nimrod, and according to Diodorus Siculus, who is one of the classical writers, Ninus, the most ancient of the Assyrian kings, and Ninus is just another name for Nimrod, mentioned in history, performed great actions, being naturally of a warlike disposition and ambitious of glory that results from valor, vigorous himself. He trained them, that is, these young men, he trained them in a long time in laborious exercises and hardships, and by that means accustomed them to bear the fatigues of war and to face dangers with fearlessness. Diodorus makes Ninus the most ancient of the Assyrian kings, represents him as beginning those wars which raised his power to extraordinary height by bringing the people of Babylonia under subjection to him. So that gives you a little bit of a summary. Just to give you a case, you know, here were these men in conditioning. You look at modern day warfare and the kind of things that are done today, they go out to war riding in mechanized equipment. I don't know what happened if they all had to walk to battle. Well, battles happen so rapidly nowadays with modern weaponry that walking and marching wouldn't even fit in this scheme anymore. But back in those days, I'll give you a case in point. Philip of Macedon was assassinated. He had an 18-year-old son by the name of Alexander, who commanded an army of 40,000 Macedonians at age 18. When Philip was assassinated, the Greek states in the south revolted. In 3 days' time, he marched his entire army the length of Greece and put down that revolt. Now, how do you think about soldiers that would run for 60 miles, rest an hour, and then go out and fight? Run another 60 miles, and then sit down and rest, and then fight. That's the kind of condition they were in. So when you train men for war, that's exactly what it's talking about. That's that kind of war. So this is what Nimrod accomplished. And this is what he did. All right, now, with that in mind, we can skip up here to verse 22, because this incident involving Nimrod is given here. Then we go to verse 22, the children of Shem. And we find the descendants of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram. And these make up what we would call the Caucasian peoples today. All of the Caucasian peoples are made up of descendants of Shem. Elamites are the fathers or are the progenitors of the Slavs. Asher, all the Germanic people. Arphaxad, all the Hebrews and Israelites. Lud, we can only identify them probably by the Berbers in North Africa. Aram, who gave rise to Gether, as you might find mentioned here in verse 23, was the father of the Goths, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths. These are all your Caucasian peoples. Now we read, Arphaxad begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber, and unto Eber were born two sons. We have the word Eber, and from this word comes the word Hebrew. All descendants, therefore, who came from Eber are referred to as Hebrews. And unto Eber were born two sons, the name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. So some incident took place here that divided the earth. We don't know what that incident is entirely. We don't know whether that's referring to what happened at the Tower of Babel. We're not sure whether it is a reference to God causing great fissures and earthquakes and whatever took place to divide the nations, to separate the continents and to raise up great mountains. We're not sure what happened, but some major incident took place here that divided the earth. And if you'll find that there's a key to this found here in Deuteronomy 32, verse number 8. We read here in verse 7, remember the days of old and consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he'll show you, your elders. They'll tell you. They should. They can't today. Most of them don't even know the name of their great-great-grandmother. That's how little. How many of you know the name of your great-great-grandmother? This is how we keep track of the past. We don't know anything. Well, God says they should have been able to look back and tell exactly what took place as a historical record, and then people would know. Nobody does. when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance. So where the nations are located or where God placed them is where he intended them to be. Now the problem is they didn't stay too long where they were supposed to be. I think they have ended up today essentially where God intended them to be, because they're much vaster in size than they were originally. But he actually appointed nations and places for them to be. When he separated, and the word segregated would be better, he separated or segregated the sons of Adam. He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. So God actually had determined where nations were to go. So we find all of the descendants of Ham, not all, but a good portion of the descendants of Ham, fundamentally in Africa. And we find the descendants of Japheth, fundamentally in Asia. And we find the descendants of Shem, fundamentally in Europe and in America, in those areas there. So something took place here. We're not sure what it was, but we can go down here now to the next chapter, chapter 11, because this is what we're going to get into, because this we're seeing here. We don't have enough information to define exactly how God divided the nations, how it was accomplished, so we can't say too much on that, but we can comment to some extent here in chapter 11, because this was another one of the great mighty acts of God. The whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east. I think we should, if you have a map in the rear of your Bible, and most of you do, if you will take a moment of time to look back there, you will see one of the general area, and it'll show you fundamentally what took place there. It shows Ararat, right on the east end of Turkey, between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, and that's where the ark came down. But we shouldn't assume that that's where they just remained. We're looking at a time period some hundreds of years after the flood. We don't know the exact time again because the Bible doesn't tell us. What we do find out is this. We know that the flood occurred in 2370 B.C. And we know that Abram was born right at about 2016 B.C. So we're looking at approximately 350 years from the time of the flood to the time of Abraham. So this period we're looking here in chapter 11, we're looking at here in chapter 11, down to verse number 26, covers a period of 350 years. Now, we might think 350 years is a short time, but let me ask you a question. How long have we been a nation and how much has happened here? Just a little over 250 years. You almost double that time, and you can imagine what could take place. I can tell you this, if the founding fathers, and they did call it a noble experiment, if they knew what was going on in the United States today, they would roll over in their graves. I mean, we have utterly lost what was really intended for this noble experiment. And I can tell you one of the things that has been largely responsible for destroying it, and that has been the intermixing of all these races and nationalities and religions and cultures. And that's one thing the Japanese say, and they're absolutely right. They say their culture is pure, and they have standards that link them together as a nation far better and more effective than we are. They're a pure race. They want to keep it that way. Anything wrong with that? Well, I can tell you this, it flies in the face of Babylonianism. And the only reason we're in the condition we're in this country today is because of Babylonianism. The mingling and the mixing together of all the races and nationalities and cultures and languages. The same thing was taking place here, but I tell you, God put a stop to it. So if you look in your map, what is very obvious is that they migrated out from Ararat, and they migrated to a large extent to the south. So we find them located in what we'd call Media and Persia. If your map in the back of your Bible shows those areas, you'll see where they were. And then they begin to migrate, as it says, from the east. And they found a plain in the land of Shinar. This great Mesopotamian plateau or plain, rich alluvial soil, and that virtual Garden of Eden for agriculture and climate. Everything just perfect. and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, go to and let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime they had for mortar. Now, if you are familiar at all with a alluvial plain, you will find that there wasn't a lot of stone there. It was mostly soil. And a lot of it was clay soil. So they were very enterprising. They took the clay, they made it into bricks. They burned it either in the sun or in kilns, whichever way they did. They had an abundance of bitumen, which they used as mortar, and they had a perfect ingredient for building. That's what they did. They said, go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top, and if you notice the words may reach, they don't belong in the original, mark them out. It'd be better just to add the word is, because that's what is meant here, whose tower is in the heaven. It just means going up. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth. Now, what instruction did God give to Noah, who was the chief patriarch? And we can assume that Noah was alive at this time when this was happening. He was instructed, didn't he? Did not God instruct Noah and his sons to replenish the earth? Did God intend for them to remain in one place? Not at all. He intended for them to go abroad and make use of the earth. But no, they weren't going to do that. So what you really see here is a rebellion against God. And there's a good chance that Nimrod was associated with it. They said, let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth, of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do, now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. And that is true. So God put a stop to it right there. That was the end of the first attempt of Babylonianism. And it is only in our day today where it is going to really gain preeminence again, because the whole system in which we live today is Babylon the Great, isn't it? A reproduction of the same thing. Intermingling of peoples and languages and cultures and races. And the pooling of knowledge and information. Now, go to. Let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of the earth, and they left off to build a city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth. This is one of the great and mighty acts of God that prevented men from rebelling and revolting against him and bringing about their own system, and probably for God having to intervene much earlier than what he will have to yet in the future. Now, I want to read a little bit here from a book entitled The Tower of Babel by André Perrault, a Frenchman. And I'll just read some excerpts from this book here because it gives some interesting information on this tower. There was a proclivity among Assyrian and Babylonian kings, Babylonian in particular, to want to repair and to keep up these various towers that were built. This one that was built at Babel was not the only tower. It was the one, however, that set off the dispersion of the languages and the dispersion of the races, because it in particular was a symbol of what man was doing. I'll just read his summary. It is interesting to find reappearing in the cuneiform accounts several features of the biblical narrative pointed out above: the baked bricks, the bitumen, and especially the idea of making the summit of a tower like that as high as the heavens. And the people in Genesis 11 used the same raw materials and had the same ambitions. So they had a proclivity for building these towers. In other words, specific reason or reasons why they were building it. The one at Babel is called Etemenaki. So if you ever run across that term, Etemenaki, that is the particular tower they're referring to that was located in Babel. It rose 7 stories to a height of 295 feet. Now stop and think for a moment. When we build a apartment house or we build a large complex, we figure that a story is 10 feet. So we're looking at a building that was almost 300 feet high. It wasn't any small building. Now there's an account by Herodotus of Halicarnassus, who visited Babylon about 460 BC. Now this was many, many years after the dispersion of the races, but that tower was still there. In the account of his journey, which contains the documentary evidence, he says, in the midst of the temple, a solid tower was constructed, 1 stadium in length, 1 stadium in width, and upon this tower stood another, and again another, and so on, making 8 towers in all. In other words, what it was sort of like the shape of a kind of a similar pyramid. In other words, you had a certain amount of height went up, then it came in, then you had another built height go up, then it came in, and then like that, and it went up like that. It had a broad base and then a series like that. So it had 8 different, I don't want to use the word stories, but 8 increments. All 8 towers can be climbed by means of a spiral staircase which runs around the outside. And about the halfway up, there are seats where those who make the ascent can sit and rest. And in the topmost tower, there's a great temple. And then he goes on to say, the account given by Herodotus contains precise and valuable information, the authenticity, which has long been acknowledged by modern archaeology. And another classical writer, Harpocration of Alexandria, brings us back from his journey to Babylon in A.D. 355, so this is several hundred years later, comments made by an old man, Assyrian, on seeing the ruined city, in particular the foot of the crumbling towers. He said it had been built by giants who wished to climb up to heaven, and for this impious folly some were struck by thunderbolts and others at God's command were unable to recognize each other. So that is a tradition that goes back to the dispersion of the races. Now, he says here that there were a number of visitors who visited this tower in Mesopotamia long before archaeologists began to go there. And those who came from Europe, that is the travelers from Europe, they were more discerning. And the history they learned rested not only on the Greek and Latin classics, but also on the Bible. Now, on the banks of the Euphrates, they were reminded of Noah and even more of Nimrod, the hunter whose mighty deeds were not all that beneficent. Indeed, to him was attributed the construction of the Tower of Babel. It is said that it was at his instigation that the rebellious people erected the tower, having decided to set themselves up in opposition to God himself if by chance he should decide to annihilate the human race a second time in a new flood, and the idea was to build a tower so high that the water would never be able to submerge it. In this way, those who were in time to take refuge there would escape the divine punishment. And that may be one idea, but I doubt whether that was a real reason, because as the authors point out here, if they were going to build a tower to escape the flood, they would have built it on top of a mountain, not down on a plain. This particular Tower of Babel was named the Gate of the Gods. And without trying to read everything here, let me say that Alexander the Great, the author says here, wishing to rebuild it, ordered the site to be cleared of debris, a Herculean task which was begun but left unfinished. The Arabs had found it an exceptionally useful source of building material, furnishing them for centuries with excellent baked bricks for their own houses. Now, I'll get here a little bit later on. You know what remains there today? Just a big hole in the ground, because the Arabs came in there and they cleaned out every bit of that brick and they took it off for building materials. So it doesn't exist anymore, but at one time it still existed. Clear as late as late B.C. period, and even as late as some of the early A.D. time periods. So this ziggurat, as it was called of Babylon, had been given the name of Etemenaki, the house or foundation of heaven and earth. And if we admit the reliability of the literary evidence, because they described its size and its height, we may conclude that the ziggurat Atamanaki rose to a height of almost 300 feet. And it rearing its imposing mass high above the flat roofs of Great Babylon, and although not referred to before the 7th century, it must have been in existence well before that date. And that's what I comment on. The classical authors don't come on the scene till about the 7th century B.C. And we know that this tower was built probably 200 years or so after the flood. And if that was in 2370 B.C., then we're looking at about 2100 B.C. So we come to 700 B.C., it is quite a span of time, but it was still there. It was, above all, the two kings, Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar, who by their embellishments invested it with splendor, which might well have made it the eighth wonder of the world. So these Babylonian kings refurbished it and put a lot into it. Today, where once there stood, that was perhaps the most gigantic structure in Babylonian civilization, there is an enormous hole full of water, and the Euphrates River, close by, filters through. So that's all it is today. It's just a hole. It was supposed to be, as he says here, the house of the foundation of heaven and earth, and the ziggurat appears to have been a bond of union whose purpose was to assure communication between heaven and earth. And even when this idea is not actually clearly expressed, it is nevertheless suggested. For what is the mountain but a giant stepladder by means of which a man may ascend or be near the sky? And then, as the author points out here, they used it as an astronomical observatory, the worship of the heavenly bodies. So they were making, really what it was an idolatrous thing for the sole purpose to fortify themselves in their rebellion against God. The instigator? Nimrod. But Nimrod may have had some guidance, because notice what Alexander of Hislop tells us here in the two Babylons. He mentions that Ninus is said, Ninus, remember, that's the Assyrian name for Nimrod, was the son of Bel, or Belus. And Bel is said to have been the founder of Babylon. Well, if Ninus was Nimrod, who was Bel? It must have been Cush. Didn't we read here? Cush begat Nimrod. So Cush, remember, who was the son of Ham, was one of the first instigators in this rebellion against God's way in the patriarchal system. Cush is generally represented as having been a ringleader in the great apostasy. Cush, as the son of Ham, was known as Hermes or Mercury. Hermes is just the Egyptian synonym for the name son of Ham. So when you read the word Hermes, if you ever run across it, it simply meant son of Ham. That, of course, would be Cush. And the distinguished Gesenius identifies him with the Babylonian Nebo as a prophetic god, in a statement of Hyginus shows that he was known as a grand agent in that movement which produced division of tongues. His words are these. Now, this is what this classical writer says. For many ages, men lived under the government of Jove, evidently not the Roman Jupiter, but the Jehovah of the Hebrews. And that's what Jove is. It's simply a correlation of Yah or Yahweh. Without cities and without laws, that is, man-made laws ruling over them, all speaking one language. But after that, Mercury, that is Cush, you see, interpreted the speeches of men, the same individual distributed the nations. Then discord began. So we see here then, Hermes or Cush or the son of Ham was the divider of the speeches of men. He seems to have been the ringleader in the scheme for building the great city and tower, but of course the one who really exercised the authority and carried out the control was none other than Nimrod. Now, one of the names of Cush is Chaos. That happens to be a name of a god. We talk about, boy, that's chaos. Whenever you say that, you're giving the name of the ancient god, and that was a representative of Cush. He was identified with Bel, the confounder. And the symbol is a club. So when you find a picture of him, he's carrying a big club. The name of the club in Chaldee comes from the very word which signifies to break in pieces or scatter abroad. So he who caused the confusions of tongues was he who broke the previously united earth in pieces and scattered the fragments abroad. How significant then is the symbol is a club commemorating the work of Cush and Bel the confounder. In fact, there's even a statement, because if you go back here in Jeremiah chapter 50, notice the statement here. Declare ye among the nations, and publish and set up a standard, publish and conceal not, say, Babylon is taken, Bel is confounded, Merodach is broken in pieces. All ancient names of Nimrod or Cush. So these things have carried right on down. In fact, as it says here, the name Merodach means the great rebel. So when you see Bel, you see confounder here, the one who's confounded, and you see Merodach, that's exactly what you're talking about, the one who confounded the nations and separated them because of his acts of rebellion against God. So as he says here, it is not difficult to see that it might be said that Bel, or Belus, that is Cush, the father of Ninus, or Nimrod, founded Babylon, while nevertheless Nimrod was properly the builder of it. And then I already read quite a section here. I won't read all this. I just thought this one was interesting here, however. You know, when the nations were scattered, they were scattered abroad. And there is a tradition, as it says here, in the Polynesian Islands, John Williams, well-known missionary, talks about this ancient tradition of the South Seas. So these people just carried it with them. And what does it describe? The heavens were originally so close to the earth that men could not walk, but were compelled to crawl under them. This was found a very serious evil, but at length an individual conceived the sublime idea of elevating the heavens to a more convenient height, and for this purpose he put forth his utmost energy and by the first effort raised them to the top of a tender plant or about 4 feet high. So now they could crawl. Then he deposited them until he was refreshed, when by a second effort he lifted them to the height of a tree which is as large as a sycamore, and by the third attempt he carried them to the summits of the mountains, and after a long interval of repose and by the most prodigious effort he elevated them to their present situation. For this he was a mighty benefactor of mankind. This individual was deified up to the moment that Christianity was embraced, and deluded inhabitants worshipped him as the elevator of the heavens. In other words, what was he doing? Freeing man from the burden, the oppressive burden that God put on him. See, that's what he did. He's called the Emancipator. And I won't read all the rest here because it would be too time consuming. But as he says here, he became the elevator of the heavens, making men feel and act as if heaven were afar off from the earth, and as if either the God of heaven could not see through the dark clouds or did not disregard the breakers of his law. Then all such would feel they could breathe freely, and now they could walk at liberty. And for this, such men could not but regard Nimrod as a high benefactor. So that gives you an idea of what took place there. Now we have the dispersion of the languages we read here. Let's go back to Genesis 11. And we read verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad. He said in verse 7, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. Now we look at languages today, and I'll read a little section here from the World Book Encyclopedia. Actually, there are about 5,000 languages in the world today. When we hear someone who has mastered a dozen languages, we just look at them with awe. Can you imagine 5,000 languages? Well, it didn't start out that way. Languages change. So the World Book Encyclopedia tells us some persons believe that all languages came from the same original tongue, which is true. In fact, there are linguists and scholars today who spend their entire time trying to determine what the first original language was. Scholars have classified languages into families, and the members of each language family are related, and they probably came from the same source or parent language. Now they give a breakdown on these languages and how many people speak them. For example, we have the Indo-European family has 8 living branches. And I won't read all of those, but it gives the numbers of people. It's 1,500,000 people speak Indo-European languages. That happens to be what language you use. What language is found in that? I'll read some of them. Icelandic, Danish, Swedish, or Scandinavian, Norwegian, Dutch, Flemish, German, English, Germanic languages, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Romanian, Albanian, Armenian, Irish, Celtic, Scot, Gaelic, Welsh, Breton, Greek, Indo-Iranian, Persian, Pashto, Bengali, Hindustani, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, Czech, Slovak, Serbo-Croatian, Slovenian, Bulgarian, Lithuanian, and Latvian all belong to the same family of languages. Why? Because they're all related. They have cognate words and their structures and so on. Now, what makes up a language is similar. But now here we have broken down then into about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about 10 different groups of languages. So the 5,000 languages that are extant in the world today come from these 10 groups. What are they? Indo-European, that's the one that I just gave here. Sino-Tibetan, Mon-Khmer, which is used in Asia, down in Cambodia and Thailand and that area. Japanese and Korean, Uralic and Altaic, which are found up in Asia. Dravidian, which is found in India, Malayo-Polynesian, African Negro, Semitic, Hamitic, and Cushite, which is all throughout Africa, and then all others classified. So 50% of the people in the world today use Indo-European. That is, all of these that I read off to you. See, but it didn't start that way. It started out with, probably, we don't know the actual number that God utilized when he broke them up into divisions. We only know that out of those divisions, out of these families, these major families, these roots, came all these different languages. That's why someone who wants to learn another Indo-European language, the ones that I read off to you there, it comes a lot easier than trying to learn one that doesn't. Because there's so many relationships and cognate words that exist between the two of them. So you see, when God confounded the languages, then as a result of changes that took place, if you go back, for example, to Old English, some of you youngsters, you may have never have experienced this. But I remember when I was in school, upper grade school and high school, we had to read whole sections of Beowulf. How many of you read Beowulf? See, not very many. That's in Old English. I mean, you can barely understand it. I mean, you have to decipher it almost like a foreign language. And after you read it for a while, you'll get used to it. It begins to come to you. But then you skip up to Middle English, and that still is very difficult for us to understand. Then you come from about 1611 on to modern English, and that's easy for us to understand. You don't stop and consider here we have this King James Version of the Bible, and here's the language that has been prime in the world since 1611 as a result of this King James Bible. There have been changes, of course. We don't use all the endings that they use, but it's certainly understandable. Go back 200 or 300 years before that, and you'll find it a bit difficult. Go back 200 or 300 years behind that, and you'll find it even more difficult. Languages change. But you do see that they came from root languages, and however many God utilized in that great act, that miraculous act that he performed there, where he confounded their languages, and they scattered abroad over the face of the earth, he stopped man's rebellion and intention to go against his will at that very early date. And in the time period in which we're living today, he is also going to stop man in what he's doing in the repeat of this same Babylonian experiment. It failed then, and God will see to it that it fails today.